to pay for this, even though Trump is saying that Mexico is going to indirectly pay for this. But as you said, something has to give. There are hundreds of thousands of people not getting paid. And so the question is, who is going to give and what that might look like?
President Trump closed out 2018 with an interview with Fox News, and we've got a clip of what he said. Let's play that.
I'm in Washington. I'm ready, willing, and able. I'm in the White House. I'm ready to go. They can come over right now. They could have come over anytime. I spent Christmas in the White House. I spent New Year's Eve now in the White House. And, you know, I'm here. I'm ready to go.
Sounds like he's just sitting there waiting for the Democrats to come over and knock on the door. Presumably he's in the mood to negotiate.
He's in the mood to talk. I don't know about negotiating. That's the question. Like, what is he going to give the Democrats that would make them come to the table? Because what the White House has been offering, it has not been enough. So what can they give to them that would make the Democrats want to make a deal? That's the question.
NPR's Ayesha Rascoe, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, as we mark this new year, take note. We are now just 672 days away from the 2020 presidential election. Sorry about that. And already four Democratic contenders have announced they're either running or are considering running. Senator Elizabeth Warren is the most high profile of those. She announced yesterday in a video message to supporters that she is forming an exploratory committee.
I'm in this fight all the way. Right now, Washington works great for the wealthy and the well-connected. It's just not working for anyone else.
The field of Democrats is likely to open up to two dozen names, all told. So how can Democrats distinguish themselves from one another? We're going to ask Anita Dunn that question. Back in 2008, Dunn helped to distinguish Senator Barack Obama from the others running for the Democratic nomination. She served as the communications director for the presidential campaign, and she joins us now. Anita, Happy New Year.
And Happy New Year to you and to your listeners.
Thanks for being here. So what do you make of Senator Warren's timing? What are the benefits and the risks of getting out so early ahead of the rest of the crowd?
I thought her timing was brilliant. Anytime you make news between Christmas and New Year's, you basically have a clear field. Even with the government shutdown, it was still, I thought, a very strong way to end the year and begin the year for her. I also thought that the way she did it, symbolic of the way people are going to do these announcements now, which is direct communication to their supporters. She also had a very clear message, which is going to be the chief differentiator for all these candidates in 2020.
I mean, you talk about what is differentiating her. In her message, she focused on economic inequality and really seemed to be tacking even more left. Is that how you think of her? Is that how she is positioning herself in this race?
You know, I don't think of it as left or right when it comes to Elizabeth Warren. She has a consistent record over the years of fighting the economic issues for the middle class. It is what propelled her into the administration, into the Obama administration. It is what propelled her into the United States Senate, and it is what has made her an effective United States senator. How that translates to the presidential campaign level will be interesting to see for all of these candidates who are thinking about running. But for Elizabeth Warren, economic inequality and economic issues around the middle class and the lower middle class, how people get taken advantage of, have been the propelling value of her political life.
Although she's had a lot of publicity as of late for really getting into it with President Trump, so much so that some Democrats have warned that she has too much political baggage. And this is the challenge for Democrats, right? How much to engage Trump in a back and forth about things that aren't related to policy? What are the pitfalls as you see them?
The winner of the Democratic nomination will be the candidate who successfully figures out how to engage Trump, how to challenge Trump, how to take him on issues, and how to communicate with the voters who voted for him in 2016. And that's why this is going to be a primary process we need to have as Democrats, because it's not clear the most effective way to do this. In 2016, we saw an entire field of Republican candidates not do it effectively. Each Democrat is going to figure out their way, but the person who wins the nomination will be the person who figures this out.
Do you think Elizabeth Warren handled it right?
I think everybody will have their fits and starts along the way. Everybody will kind of feel out what their style will be.
That sounds like a no.
It's not a no, it's not a yes, because I don't tend to think that things that happened in 2018 are going to be determinative of who wins the nomination in 2020.
Right. It's a couple of years away.
It's a couple of years away. And every candidate is going to make their mistakes in this, Rachel.
I mean, it sounds like you like her, though. I mean, there's a long list of people who are thinking about throwing their hat in the ring. Kamala Harris, Cory Booker, faces we know, Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders. Does she stand out in that crowd, or do you like someone else?
I'm like a lot of Democrats. I like whoever can beat Donald Trump. And I like all the candidates who are running. I know many of them. I've worked with some of them. They're all very, in their own ways, effective, great public servants. And it's why this is going to be a very valuable primary process for the Democratic Party. We, as a party, have issues to sort out. And this primary process will allow us to do it.
Is it going to be dangerous to have so many in the field, though, to get these candidates all battered up before the general?
No, I think the larger field means that it's harder for one candidate to become a lightning rod, at least at the beginning. And it gives some of the lesser-known candidates time to develop their messages. Having an open primary process is better for this party than a small group of people who ran. I didn't think 2016 was healthy for the party. I think this is healthier.
Anita Dunn, former communications director for Barack Obama. We appreciate your time this morning.
Well, thank you for having me, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Speaking of the New Year, France rang in 2019 under a cloud of heavy security. In the wake of a recent terror attack and social unrest that spread out across the country, France's President Emmanuel Macron used his annual address to call for unity. Jake Saganero has the report from Paris.
The excitement of the hundreds of thousands of people on the Champs-Élysées on New Year's Eve was a stark contrast to another crowd that has gathered here each week since November. The French Yellow Vests, a national movement that started as a protest against a fuel tax, but has morphed into a larger expression of middle and working class discontent. The French Interior Minister said more than 10,000 police and soldiers had been deployed in Paris for the celebration. France has been on high terror alert since the shooting at the Christmas market in Strasbourg last month, and the Yellow Vest had also called for a peaceful gathering on the Champs-Élysées, but their protests have frequently turned violent. However, there were no clashes with police or any major incidents on New Year's Eve. Earlier in the evening, President Emmanuel Macron gave the presidential New Year's address in a televised speech. Standing in his office in the Élysée Palace, Macron said his three wishes for 2019 are truth, dignity, and hope.
Nous voulons changer les choses pour vivre mieux.
Macron says, for me, the lesson of 2018 is we want to change things in order to live better, and we want to innovate in our plans for democracy, politics, economy, and the environment. But, he said, to do this, France cannot close itself off to the world.
Il serait dangereux que notre situation...
It would be dangerous if our situation drives us to ignore the world around us. Quite the opposite, Macron says. He said the government will continue to roll out his ambitious reforms, including in education and taxes, some of which sparked the Yellow Vest movement more than a month ago. After a particularly violent day of protests last month, Macron tried to calm tensions by canceling the fuel tax that caused the uproar in the first place. He also raised minimum wage. Following his concessions, there was a significant drop-off in Yellow Vest numbers, but protesters have continued to gather, although fewer and fewer each week. Just a few weeks ago, more than 280,000 people had turned out across France, according to authorities. But over the weekend, only a few hundred Yellow Vests gathered in Paris. However, Yellow Vest organizers say they plan to return in full force in January. Post-holiday protests will be an indicator of how much steam the movement really has left. For NPR News, I'm Jake Saganero in Paris.
This is NPR News.
Good morning. It's 8:19 on this New Year's Day. This is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on the program, in his New Year address, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un declared that, while denuclearization is still his goal, his nation may have to follow a, quote, new path if the U.S. insists on unilateral action on that issue. We'll hear more from NPR's Anthony Kuhn in 15 minutes here on WPR.
Wisconsin Public Radio Travel has three adventures planned for the second half of 2019. In July, we're sponsoring a holiday vacations trip to Alaska and the Inside Passage by ship, rail, and motor coach. We team again with Holiday Vacations in September for a vacation in Italy.
In October, we head to South America with Fox World Travel to explore the vineyards of Argentina and Chile. Details on all three trips can be found at WPR.org/travel.
Contributors to WPR include Washington Island Chamber, Maggie's Restaurant, and the John Michael Kohler Art Center. You too can help ensure the future of WPR with your business sponsorship. Go to WPR.org/sponsor. WPR is your home for national, international, and Wisconsin news, from breaking stories to the latest from the state capitol. Informed political and economic coverage, stories about the environment, intriguing conversations, and more each day on Wisconsin Public Radio.
There may be some flurries this morning, highs in the teens in the north and 20s in the south. Tomorrow, there's a chance for flurries or brief snow showers in eastern Wisconsin. Otherwise, you can expect sunny skies, but the low temperatures will continue. The northern part of the state will have highs in the teens. Some areas in the north could see wind chills in the negatives. On Thursday, it'll start to warm up a bit, with highs in the 30s for most of the state. It'll be mostly sunny with light winds. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the law firm Cooley LLP. With offices in the U.S., Europe, and China, Cooley advises entrepreneurs, investors, financial institutions, and established companies around the world where innovation meets the law. From Tire Rack, offering a tire decision guide to help customers find tires that fit their car and driving conditions. With a network of more than 7,000 independent installers, TireRack.com, helping drivers find, deliver, install. And from Atlassian, a collaboration software company powering teams around the world, committed to providing the tools and practices to help teams plan, track, build, and work better together. More at Atlassian.com.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin. It has been 1 year since the Republican-controlled Congress slashed corporate and personal tax rates. The promises and boasts at the time assured years of economic growth.
This is the kind of tax reform and tax cuts that get our economy growing to reach its potential. This gets us better wages, bigger paychecks.
And ultimately, what does it mean? It means jobs, 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 jobs.
That was President Trump, preceded by outgoing House Speaker Paul Ryan. So how are things going today? The economy is still strong, with growth topping 4% in one quarter of 2018. And unemployment remains at a near 50-year low. But how much of that has to do with those tax cuts? Noel King put that question to Richard Rubin. He covers tax policy for the Wall Street Journal.
A year after the tax cut took effect, where do we stand?
We've gotten some of what we would expect and some of what the proponents had hoped for. I think we've seen some increased investment, but it decelerated some in the third quarter. We've seen unemployment continue to drop, but it was already on the way there. We've seen people have more money in their pockets, and so we've seen some economic growth, particularly in the short run, because people had money to spend as their paychecks got bigger in the first part of the year from the individual side of the tax cuts. And now what we're looking for to really see is that going to last? Is there going to be not just a one-time bump from people having money in their pockets and spending, but is there going to be the kind of sustained, prolonged economic boom with 3% growth year after year after year that the administration says is possible, and that most economists were pretty skeptical of the ability of this tax law and other administration policies to get the U.S. economy there?
So some wait and see here.
Some of the effects are clear. There are bigger budget deficits. It was a large tax cut, and people will feel that on the individual side as they're filing their returns in the coming months. And one other thing I'd add is that companies are still trying to figure this out about what incentives they have. A lot of the pieces of this law are really complicated, particularly on international taxation. And the Treasury Department has been putting out tons and tons of regulations over the course of 2018. And companies are still really trying to grapple with that to understand exactly what the new incentives are. And so what you've seen from companies so far is they've done a lot of share buybacks. We saw that early in the year and continuing throughout the year. Companies had free money and they bought back their own shares. And we've seen some additional investment, but not necessarily as much as the administration had hoped.
You mentioned a trend that we've been seeing in which companies that got the tax break used some of the extra money that they had to buy back their stock. And that raised eyebrows. Why is that?
Well, it raised eyebrows because it's not a direct investment. It's, you know, it really is trying to prop up the share price. It's trying to help investors. You know, you've seen some companies do dividends as well. The counter argument to that would be this, that if you get more money to investors, then companies that might want investment, might have the need for investment, can get money from those investors. But the buybacks have become a political football for sure, because the opponents of the tax law can easily point to them and say, look, the people who are benefiting here are really the shareholders.
It's not the employees, which this was supposed to benefit.
I would say two things about that. One is that employees for sure were supposed to benefit from the corporate tax cuts, but that was going to take time. It was the causal chain that we just talked about of tax cut and then investment and then productivity growth and then hiring was never going to be a one-year proposition. And then on top of that, of course, employees are getting tax cuts on the individual side as well.
That was Richard Rubin of The Wall Street Journal talking with our co-host, Noel King. There's a new probe in orbit around the moon. And sometime earlier in this new year, it's expected to land on the moon's far side, the side we never see from Earth. It is a Chinese probe. And as NPR's Joe Palca explains, although it's essentially a scientific mission, it's also laying the groundwork for sending Chinese astronauts to the moon.
It only makes sense to send machines to the moon before trying to send humans.
Before Neil Armstrong set foot on the moon, the United States sent 21 robotic missions to the moon to prepare the way.
Jim Head is a planetary scientist at Brown University. He says he's convinced the Chinese are doing the same thing.
The robotic program is providing all the kinds of background that you would need for building spacesuits and things like that, like lunar rovers. So they're building towards human exploration for sure.
That's not to say there won't be interesting science to come from the mission. Brian E. Horgan is a planetary scientist at Purdue University.
This mission is really exciting because it's the first time any space agency will have landed on the far side of the moon.
Horgan says scientists know the far and near sides are very different.
The far side is actually much more primitive. It contains really ancient crust that dates back to the very, very early solar system. There's rocks all over the far side that are over 4 billion years old, and that we're really excited to see what those look like up close.
Now, it may seem odd that with so much to explore on the far side, all the landing probes to date have gone to the near side.
That's mostly because it's a lot easier to communicate with, right? I mean, we can actually see the near side, and so we get direct radio communication with the entire near side of the moon.
Horgan says the Chinese have solved that problem by adding a third component to the mission. The first component is a lander. The lander carries the second component, a mobile rover.
And then the third component is a satellite that's going to stay in orbit above the far side of the moon and act as a relay between the Earth and the far side of the moon.
It might be handy if U.S. lunar missions could also use the relay satellite, but that's not likely. Official collaboration between NASA and the Chinese space program is essentially prohibited by law. There are also restrictions on exporting U.S. space technology to China. But Brown University's Jim Head says some amount of collaboration just makes sense.
Why would we send a spacecraft to the same location to do exactly the same thing when we can optimize the amount of scientific return for the United States and for other countries by collaborating as best we can?
And while China may not be as forthcoming as NASA about what their civilian space program is up to, Head says they're not completely opaque either.
If you talk to the right people, they're not holding things back. There are security issues there from their point of view as well as ours. But nonetheless, they've been very forthcoming with their civilian space program.
The United States has its own lunar ambitions. The Trump administration has asked NASA to focus on returning humans to the moon. It's just possible there will already be Chinese astronauts there when they arrive. Joe Palca, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Remember this?
Oh, I'd love to be an Oscar Mayer wiener.
That's how companies used to build brand loyalty. But consumerism has changed and companies are struggling to keep up.
It is a big challenge to reinvent yourself over and over again.
I'm Audie Cornish. How new shopping habits have forced big brands to adapt. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 here on Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8:29 now. You're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio, and a news update from NPR is next. Then in the WPR newscast, hormone treatment and transgender surgeries are now covered by insurance for state employees. Details on that story coming up in just a minute on WPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. The California Attorney General's office says it will appeal a Texas judge's ruling that found the Affordable Care Act unconstitutional. Sarah Husseini from member station KQED reports.
California Attorney General Javier Becerra and 16 other states had asked the court to keep the law, also known as Obamacare, in place while the case challenging it winds its way through the courts. U.S. District Court Judge Reed O'Connor agreed on Sunday that without a stay, everyday Americans could face great uncertainty. Residents in many states have already signed up for their insurance plans for 2019. In a statement, Becerra vowed to march forward in the effort to, quote, keep health care affordable and accessible to millions of Americans. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Husseini in San Francisco.
Special military forces in Afghanistan launched a new offensive against the Taliban today. This follows two overnight attacks by Taliban fighters. NPR's Dia Hadid has more.
Residents fled the area, fearing they'd get caught in the fighting. Taliban insurgents have relentlessly attacked Afghan forces, and some 28,000 have been killed since 2015. The attacks have come despite efforts by the United States to negotiate an end to the country's conflict. That's been complicated by reports that President Trump wants to withdraw about half the U.S. troops stationed in Afghanistan.
This is NPR News.
This is news from Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8:31. I'm Hannah Haynes. Starting today, insurance for state employees will once again cover hormone treatment and transgender surgeries. This past August, the state's group insurance board restored coverage of those services for state workers. Ren Logan is a medical resident at the UW-Madison. She says surgery for many transgender people is necessary to function.
It's hard sometimes to just be able to kind of sit with, you know, the fact that these, my, who I am and what I am isn't in alignment with, you know, my body.
The group insurance board approved coverage in 2016, but it reversed course last year at the request of Governor Scott Walker. A Wisconsin prosecutor will announce whether any police officers will be charged for fatally shooting a software worker who opened fire on his fellow employees in September. Middleton Police Chief Charles Folk says the Dane County District Attorney will release the findings next Monday. Two Dane County Sheriff's Office deputies and two Middleton police officers were in a shootout with Anthony Tong inside WTS Paradigm's Middleton offices. Tong was fatally shot. Three people were seriously wounded in the attack but survived. All four law officers have been put on paid leave while the State Division of Criminal Investigation investigates. Under Wisconsin law, outside investigations are required for all officer-involved shootings. The Wisconsin State Journal reports all four officers were interviewed by DCI investigators. A boost in the number of state tax auditors generated an additional $72 million in revenue for Wisconsin in 2018. The Wisconsin State Journal reports additional auditors found out-of-state businesses that owe a variety of Wisconsin taxes under existing law. In the 2015 state budget, lawmakers set aside nearly $14 million to fund more than 100 additional positions with the State Department of Revenue. The goal was to better ensure businesses outside the state were paying their required Wisconsin taxes. Before the state added the additional positions, it had a running average of 290 tax auditors. You can expect some flurries this morning and highs in the teens in the north and 20s in the south. Tomorrow, there's a chance for flurries or brief snow showers in eastern Wisconsin. Otherwise, you can expect sunny skies, but the low temperatures will continue. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Rhodes Scholar, a nonprofit organization offering educational learning adventures for families, grandparents, and grandchildren. A catalog is available at roadscholar.org. From the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin. North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un says he is ready to meet with President Trump at any time. He made that offer in a televised New Year's address. He also recommitted himself to abandoning nuclear weapons, but only if the U.S. sticks to its promises. NPR's Anthony Kuhn joins us now from Seoul to talk about what all this could mean. Good morning, Anthony. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Rachel.
So after the Singapore summit last year, when President Trump met face-to-face with Kim Jong-un, Trump says, quote, "We are ready to write a new chapter between our nations." So in light of this address from Kim Jong-un, are you seeing any evidence of a new chapter?
No, the speech was pretty much what analysts expected, and it didn't leave much room for optimism that the current stalemate over the nuclear issue is going to be broken soon. Kim said in his speech that he's serious about improving relations with the U.S. and completely denuclearizing the Korean Peninsula. But he also, he continued the North Korean line, which for months has been, look, we've made gestures to the U.S., such as dismantling nuclear and missile test sites, and now it's up to the U.S. It's the U.S.'s turn to reciprocate by easing sanctions or giving some sort of security guarantee. Let's hear a clip of Kim speaking today.
다만 미국이 세계 앞에서 한 자기 약속을 지키지 않고
If the U.S. fails to keep the promises it made before the world, he says, if it misjudges the patience of our people and continues to use sanctions and pressure against our republic, then we'll have no choice except to seek a new path to secure the sovereignty and interests of our country. And he did not say, Rachel, exactly what this new path is, but he did describe the old path as one of the most hostile relations in the world between the U.S. and North Korea, and it suggested that he might go back to that. We noted that he was speaking from a very plushly upholstered sofa in a wood-paneled office, and clearly this appeared to make him look like calculated to make him look like a mature statesman rather than a dictator.
So what exactly does he want right now? Kim Jong-un.
Well, you remember from the summit in Singapore that they reached the vaguest of deals and that the U.S. and North Korea have completely different understandings of denuclearization. And the North Korea has stuck to their definition, which is that they expect the U.S. to remove the U.S. nuclear umbrella that protects South Korea and Japan. And from the U.S. side, that's not on the negotiating table. And today, Kim added on. He said, we want to see an end to U.S.-South Korean joint military exercises that President Trump suspended after the summit.
I want to pivot to the South because the U.S. and South Korea were supposed to strike this new deal about the price of keeping U.S. military, U.S. military footprint in South Korea. And they were supposed to agree to this by New Year's Eve. They didn't. So now what?
Well, the U.S. is asking for all its allies to cough up more money. South Korean media report that the U.S. is looking for a 50% increase, and South Korea says no to that. Seoul was not happy about the U.S. pullout from Syria and the resignation of Mattis. And they point out, look, if you pull out of South Korea, you're not just undermining our defense, you're undermining the entire U.S. military posture in Asia.
NPR's Anthony Kuhn from Seoul. Thanks so much, Anthony.
You bet, Rachel.
In 2018, we saw a lot of devastating wildfires in the state of California. During our coverage, we heard from people conflicted about whether or not to rebuild in the same areas that burned to the ground. But just weeks after the deadly Camp Fire, a massive new housing development was approved in a high fire risk area near Los Angeles. Reporter Emily Guerin from member station KPCC took a look at the financial bet of rebuilding.
Back in September, the Orange County Board of Supervisors approved a new housing development called Esperanza Hills. It's 340 luxury homes on an undeveloped patch of land. It's got amazing views of hills and canyons, and Kevin Johnson thinks it's a disaster waiting to happen.
This site is probably the most dangerous site in Southern California that you could pick to put 340 new families into.
He's a lawyer for one of the environmental groups that opposes the project. And he says what makes this site so dangerous is that a huge wildfire swept through here just 10 years ago.
Go ahead and drive.
And this recording by Casper News, a man is rushing his wife into their car as a helicopter dumps water on the flames nearby. People who lived through it say the evacuation was chaotic and they barely got out. Ed Schumann's house and 380 others burned down that day, and he does not like the idea of adding hundreds more houses to the community.
Evacuating that more many people in the same limited infrastructure, it's a scary thought.
So why would anyone want to build in such a risky place?
California is woefully deficient in housing units.
And he's right. That's the developer of Esperanza Hills, Douglas Wymore.
When somebody comes in to develop, it's going to be the areas that aren't currently developed, right?
In fact, more than 60% of new houses on the West Coast are in high fire risk areas. But Wymore maintains that it is possible to build here safely. His homes will be fire resistant, he says. They'll have lots of brush clearing and two water tanks for firefighting.
I think that the bottom line is you can mitigate it and you can protect it.
So that's the developer. But why would the Orange County Board of Supervisors approve the project? Here's one factor.
It will generate $8,250,000 in property tax.
That's Gary Lamb, who works with Wymore. At a public meeting last year, he listed off how much money the project will generate for the community.
$4 million will go to the Placentia-Yorba Linda School District.
And since 2011, Wymore has donated nearly $50,000 to the political campaigns of various members of the OC Board of Supervisors. Now, none of the supervisors wanted to talk to me for this story. But in a meeting last May, Supervisor Sean Nelson explained one reason why he was signing off on the project. The fire department had already given it the green light.
If the fire department's satisfied, I'm not inclined to argue with them. I'm not a fireman.
But Timothy Kerbrot is a fireman in Orange County. And he says, from what he's seen so far, the project does meet state and local requirements.
Do they have access? Do they have water? Do they have a defensible space? Do they have hardened structures that they can protect? Are all those things occurring?
And in the Esperanza Hills project, he says they are. But here's the thing. If there's a fire, Orange County won't actually have to spend much of its own money to protect the neighborhood. The state and federal governments will reimburse them. Kimiko Barrett is a researcher at Headwaters Economics, which studies land use.
The consequences actually aren't borne by the people who are approving these developments.
She calls it a moral hazard. And until this changes, she says we're going to keep building in risky areas. For NPR News, I'm Emily Guerin.
This is NPR News.
It's 8:42 now. Good morning and Happy New Year. I'm Hannah Haynes. Thanks for joining us here on Wisconsin Public Radio. In the newest installment of the popular show Black Mirror, Netflix is trying something totally different. They're letting viewers choose their own adventure while they watch the episode. Steve Inskeep talks to a writer from Variety magazine about how Netflix pulled it off. That conversation in 9 minutes here on WPR.
All Things Considered gives you the latest news. It's the deepest, most meaningful analysis of the news and what it means for people. News is not just what's happening as it's happening. It's what it means. And I think that makes All Things Considered unique.
Tune in to All Things Considered for news from NPR and WPR, weekdays at 4 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
On WPR, you get thoughtful programming that brings you news and information from close to home and from around the world. Contributing members, including the growing number of sustainers, keep WPR's future secure. Thank you. Support also comes from Goodwill of South Central Wisconsin, thanking their neighbors for supporting local job readiness programs by generously donating clothing and household items. Local Goodwill locations are at goodwillscwi.org.
Good morning. I'm Hannah Haynes in for Melissa Ingalls today. Here are some of the stories we're following this morning. House Democrats have unveiled two bills to fund the government and put thousands of federal employees back to work, but the bills don't include money for President Donald Trump's wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. Democrats plan to pass the bills as soon as they take control of the House when the new Congress convenes Thursday. A NASA spacecraft opens the new year at the most distant world ever explored, a billion miles beyond Pluto. Flight controllers say everything looked good for New Horizons' flyby of the tiny, icy object. And Wisconsin's unemployment is holding steady at 3%. Morning Edition is almost over today, but you can listen to All Things Considered this afternoon for updates on the day's news. That's from 4 to 6:30 today. Some flurries this morning, highs in the teens in the north, highs in the 20s in the south, and there's a chance of flurries in eastern Wisconsin tomorrow. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Babbel, a language app that teaches real-life conversations in a new language, like Spanish, French, or German. Babbel's 10 to 15-minute lessons are available in the App Store or online at Babbel, BABBEL.com. From American Jewish World Service, working together for more than 30 years to build a more just and equitable world. Learn more at ajws.org. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin. The sound of crowds out in the street in Brazil's capital, Brasilia, last night, welcoming the new year in traditional fashion. But 2019 is bringing a change for Brazil. Today, a new president is being sworn into office. His name is Jair Bolsonaro, a retired army captain from the far right. We're joined from Brasilia now by NPR's Philip Reeves. Hey, Phil.
Hi, how you doing?
Doing well, thanks. So this is a huge day for Brazil, also for Latin America more broadly. Can you just give us a sense of how important this moment is?
Oh, well, it's extremely important. This is a real moment in history. Latin America's largest nation is installing a populist president, a seven-term congressman with no executive experience, a man who admires Brazil's past dictatorship and has a cabinet of whom about a third are retired military officers, and a chosen foreign minister who's described climate change as a Marxist plot. So this is a moment in history, a turning point.
What's it like in Brasilia on the inauguration day?
Well, I'm afraid it's damp and overcast, rather disappointingly.
Oh.
Nonetheless, you know, officials here are expecting big crowds for the inauguration, possibly 500,000. So there's a huge security operation. But it's also New Year's Day, and Brazilians really celebrate at New Year's, as you know. And so let's see whether they turn up and how many of them decide to carry on partying somewhere else.
I mean, Bolsonaro had been seen as this very divisive figure, right? During the campaign, hundreds of thousands of Brazilians, especially women, were on the streets urging people not to vote for him. So is that changing?
Yes. I mean, Bolsonaro was elected in October with a very comfortable margin of some 10 million votes. Polls indicate, though, that since then he's become even more popular. It seems Brazilians have really high expectations of him. And you often meet people here who say that they don't agree with everything Bolsonaro stands for, but anything's better than the leftist government that ruled for most of the last decade and a half, a period that saw the country's worst ever recession, a massive corruption scandal, and an epidemic of violent crime. I was actually out in the streets here when New Year dawned earlier today, talking to people about their new president, and I met Alan Hubner, a computer programmer, and I asked him to tell me why he supports Bolsonaro.
Security. Yeah, I want to feel safe here, you know?
Hubner told me that he's gay, and Bolsonaro, of course, is notorious for making offensive homophobic comments. A lot of LGBT Brazilians are worried about what his presidency might mean for them. And I asked Hubner about that, and he says, in a country where there are tens of thousands of homicide every year, making Brazil safer matters more to him than anything Bolsonaro said in the past.
People say that he's homophobic. Oh, he's homophobic. He's going to kill gays. I don't believe he's going to kill gays. I believe that everybody's getting killed here. It doesn't matter if you're gay, if you're straight, if you're black, if you're white. Everybody's getting killed here.
I mean, that's going to be a huge issue that Bolsonaro is going to have to deal with, clearly, if people feel that way. But what can you tell us about other policy agenda, the other policy agenda items that Bolsonaro is going to focus on?
Well, all eyes are going to be on what he does with the environment. He's been talking about withdrawing from the Paris Climate Change Agreement. Bolsonaro is also a big fan of President Trump and used some of his tactics during the election campaign, communicating directly, for example, via internet. So we're going to see a shift here towards the U.S., and that has regional implications, for example, in the handling of Venezuela. Meanwhile, domestically here in Brazil, Bolsonaro wants to greatly increase the public's access to firearms. That's very controversial, so we'll see what happens there.
All right, NPR's Phil Reeves from Brasilia, the capital of Brazil. This is NPR News.
Good morning. It's 10 minutes before 9 o'clock. Thanks for tuning in to Wisconsin Public Radio today. The UW-Madison women's basketball team beat Purdue yesterday, 76-69. The men's basketball team is ranked 22nd and will play Minnesota on Thursday.
Bring joy to children in our community. It's Three Kings Day. Kids celebrate this traditional holiday at Centro Hispano of Dane County, January 12th from 10 to noon, with the help of donated gifts and toys. WPR is pleased to support community connections. To learn more, visit mecentro.org.
Good morning and Happy New Year. It's Morning Edition on WPR. The program is almost over for today, but Morning Classics with Stephanie Elkins is coming up next. She'll bring you a special on this New Year's Day. Stay with us for that music in about 10 minutes here on WPR. There may be some flurries this morning, highs in the teens in the north and 20s in the south. Tomorrow, you can expect sunny skies, but low temperatures will continue. The northern part of the state will have highs in the teens. Some areas in the north could see wind chills in the negatives.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin. National Cathedral here in Washington, D.C. often hosts big, important ceremonies like the funeral of President George H.W. Bush last month. It's also the workplace of some of the most skilled stonemasons in the country. And those masons are in the midst of a massive renovation project. Michaela Lafrac from member station WAMU got a firsthand view.
All right, let's see, Michaela. Step on these planks.
All right.
You good?
I think I'm good.
Welcome to the top of the world.
This is what it sounds like to be on scaffolding 300 feet above the nation's capital. The cathedral's head stonemason, Joe Alonso, is showing me around its central tower.
We're probably 60-some feet higher in elevation right now than the top of the Washington Monument. This is probably going to be the biggest stone restoration job in this country, not a doubt.
7 years ago, a rare earthquake hit Washington. The cathedral remained open, but it sustained more than $30 million in damage to its Gothic pinnacles, finials, buttresses, and spires.
Every one of these pinnacles that you see have rotated and moved and have snapped, so they're all loose.
The cathedral's construction took most of the 20th century. It's the sixth largest cathedral in the world. Stoneworkers, many from Italy, carved its Gothic details, like gargoyles and angels, by hand. Inside a dusty masonry shop around the corner, stonemason Andy Yule carves a hunk of limestone with a steel chisel and mallet. It will eventually form part of a pinnacle, replacing one that fell off during the earthquake.
And this whole building was done this way, one chip at a time.
Nearby, carver Sean Callahan is drawing up designs for the top of the pinnacle with a stubby pencil.
And once I have that all plotted out, then I can start carving.
Yule and Callahan say there's lots of work for them here in Washington, thanks to all the federal government buildings and monuments. They've carved everything from delicate flowers on the White House to eyebrows on angels atop the cathedral. But their trade is a dying art. Callahan says his biggest job competitors these days are robots.
They can't do everything a person can do, but robots are getting better every day at reproducing this type of work.
At National Cathedral, the human crew has great job security. The cathedral still has to raise about $20 million more dollars to complete the earthquake repairs. Alonso says there are at least five more years of work to do. But to him, every chip in the stone is worth it.
And it's just incredible. I still, as a stonemason, You look at this thing and it still amazes me.
From the top of the tower, he points out local and national landmarks. And with the wind whipping around us, it really does feel like the top of the world. For NPR News, I'm Michaela Lafrac in Washington.
Netflix recently put some of the power of storytelling into the hands of viewers. The series Black Mirror is a lot like The Twilight Zone. Each episode is a unique science fiction tale. But the episode that debuted this past weekend, called Bandersnatch, isn't a single linear story. You, the viewer, are constantly asked to pick outcomes for the main character. It's kind of like those choose-your-own-adventure books. For example, early in the show, you have to pick which box of cereal the main character opens, and that changes the story arc from that point forward.
How about you decide what you want for your breakfast?
This is obviously just a simple choice, but from there on, it gets more and more complicated.
The second voice is that of Yanko Rutgers from Variety magazine. He's been reporting on how Netflix and the Black Mirror team pulled all this off. He spoke with our co-host, Noel King.
You make very hard choices at some point, and sometimes it also throws you off a little bit, and maybe you even find one of these questions that only has one choice.
Do you know how many possible outcomes there were, given all of the choices that you make for this character, this young man?
Netflix did the math on this, and they say there's 1 trillion possible permutations of this show. In reality, you wouldn't notice the difference between many of these, but there are quite a few different outcomes. So I got to see this a couple of weeks ago at Netflix, and I spent 90 minutes, I think, exploring it. And so I got to see quite a bit of this, and I thought I saw almost everything. But then a couple of days ago, I watched it again with my wife, and she made just a few different choices. And not only did she see a lot of things in a different order, but she also arrived at an ending that I had never seen before. So it kind of almost felt like she watched a completely different movie.
That is amazing. I didn't realize that the small choices had so much impact down the line. So how did Netflix pull this off? I'm just trying to imagine filming this, and it must have been kind of a logistical nightmare.
Yeah, and even before they started to film this, they had to develop their own script writing tool for this that would kind of help them branch the narrative, try to figure out which choices end up where, how they can all this bring all these strings back together and so forth. And I talked to the masterminds behind Black Mirror, and they said at first it was pretty much a nightmare. At some point, even their script writing tool kind of broke down, and they had never a script crash on them before, but in this case it actually happened.
So the main character is a young man, and there are points at which you can choose paths for him that you know will put him in harm's way versus paths that will seemingly like just put him on a, you know, a bus or something, right? And I found myself really thinking about what kind of person I was, particularly when the show sort of started getting slow and I'd choose to make some action happen. Do you feel like you learned anything about yourself as you made choices on whether to put this young man in harm's way and potentially make things more interesting, or to keep him out of danger but maybe be a little bored?
That is a really good question. I think the show plays with that as well. Do you want to have good entertainment, or do you want to actually empathize with the characters and kind of give them an easy way out, if you will? They also played with the question whether the character has any choices, because you make choices for him. But at some point, it's also the question, do you actually have any real choices? Because if you arrive over and over again at the same point, is it the script writers that kind of dictate where you go? Are you dictating where this character goes? It's a really interesting thing, and I think it's kind of a Black Mirror take on interactivity, if you will.
Yanko Rutgers reports for Variety. Yanko, thanks so much. This was fun.
Thanks for having me.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News, hoping you get to choose your own adventure in 2019. I'm Rachel Martin.
I'm Hannah Haynes. Morning Edition is on the air every weekday from 5 to 9 here on Wisconsin Public Radio. And to follow developments throughout the day, visit WPR.org. There you can check out our statewide reports from WPR's award-winning news team, plus national and global headlines from NPR.
Support for WPR comes from Glass Nickel Pizza. 21 years of employee and customer-inspired pizzas made from scratch at 8 Wisconsin locations. Dedicated to sustainability practices and community support. GlassNickelPizza.com. Support also comes from Farley's House of Pianos, hosting the intimate salon concert of the Salon Piano Series, presenting the chamber music of Trio Celeste, Sunday, January 6th. Details are at salonpianoseries.org.